Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, we sometimes have shows on the environment on American Variety, and sometimes shows on animals, different aspects of animals. And we've had lots of adventurers of different kinds over the years. I mean, some very exotic, you know, explorers and interesting people. This week's show combines all three of those themes. My guests are Carlton Ward, who's a wildlife photographer for National Geographic and the Smithsonian in various countries, and a writer on conservation topics, especially focusing on Florida in recent years. I read about the topic of today's show in an article he wrote, for example, in the magazine of the Florida Humanities Council. And my second guest is Mallory Dimmitt, who is a conservationist. She used to work for the Nature Conservancy in Colorado, where she designed a conservation program, and she's now the executive director of the Florida project we'll be talking about. They're both native Floridians going way back. In Mallory's case, she's a seventh-generation Floridian, and Carlton is eighth-generation. I mean, I'm proud of the fact that I'm a third-generation Miamian, and I think that's something, but seventh and eighth generation takes you back to, like, pre-Civil War. I mean, that's extremely rare in Florida. So they're dyed-in-the-wool Floridians. Glad to have them on. And Carlton and Mallory were both part of a team of people who, in 2012, undertook an expedition in Florida with a particular mission. Carlton, why don't you start off and describe what you all did and why?
Thank you, Court. Well, back in 2012, we undertook a 1,000-mile, 100-day trek that allowed us to travel from the Everglades National Park at the southern tip of Florida to the Okefenokee Swamp in southern Georgia. And the route of our trek followed the best remaining corridor for wildlife that we can still connect throughout the Florida Peninsula. There were a team of four of us on this trip, and it consisted of myself, Mallory, bear biologist Joe Guthrie, and filmmaker Elam Stolzis.
So what were you doing? What was the purpose of the trip?
The purpose of the Florida Wildlife Quarter expedition was to show that a connected corridor throughout our state is still possible, that a bear or a panther, or in our cases, a person, can still travel the entire length of the state on natural or semi-natural habitat.
Wow. So in 2012, you were trying to go all the way from the southern tip of the long, skinny peninsula of Florida up past the northern boundary with Georgia into the Okefenokee Swamp in Georgia without leaving green space, in other words, and following more or less a wild pathway all the way up through the state. My gosh, how hard was it to map out a totally green, unspoiled route for, as you say, 1,000 miles? Now, Florida's only about 400 miles long, so I think it was a very wiggly course you must have taken up through the state, right? How hard was it to map out where to go?
Well, the mapping of the route was easier than you would think in some areas, but also very arduous and difficult. I mean, we end up planning, you know, 100 yards at a time, the entire 1,000-mile journey, so that we know exactly where we're going to be on any given day, so that we can coordinate with local politicians or local media and schedule events for the public and so forth. The Florida Wildlife Quarter opportunity to which we're bringing attention consists of approximately half public land that's already in conservation status and the other half private land, which is predominantly working agricultural landscape. So we had to get a lot of permission, and we had to decide which private lands to showcase. And we did so based on knowing which landowners were interested or open to doing long-term conservation solutions for those properties.
It sounds like that took a lot of communication and negotiation in advance with a whole lot of people. I mean, I know just from reading the article that, as you say, you pieced together a whole patchwork, let's say, of wildlife preserves and nature trails and state parks, farms and ranches, and even military bases and training areas. I mean, a lot of different entities, both public and private, as you say. Was it a tremendous communication and let's call it selling job to a lot of the ranchers and farmers and private landowners along the way to let you go through there and kind of nominally make their piece of land potentially part of this corridor?
It was definitely a process, and we were careful and purposeful about the way we approached it. We went and sat down, Mallory and I and Joe, with most of the large landowners ahead of time. You don't want them to hear about this type of large-scale vision in a newspaper. You want to talk about it face-to-face. Hmm. I had been working for 6 years prior photographing for my previous book, Florida Cowboys. So I had a lot of personal relationships with a lot of the landowners. And, you know, we crossed land owned by Mallory's family, and we camped on cattle ranches owned by three of my first cousins in the corridor. So that heritage was certainly helpful. The other thing that was a big help was that our state agencies, particularly the Fish and Wildlife Commission, in partnership with groups like U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, had been doing some workshops and stakeholder meetings about landscape connections. It wasn't necessarily the whole statewide vision that we're fighting for, but things like the Everglades Headwaters projects and others. So most of the big landowners in this area were already part of an early conversation about how their land fit the bigger puzzle for statewide conservation.
So, wow, 100 days, I mean, that's a third of a year, 3 months or whatever. What restrictions or stipulations did you guys place on yourselves? That's an awfully long camping trip. Did you stay in hotels sometimes or eat in restaurants, or did you take breaks from the trek at some points, or was it just totally rigorous and focused?
We never left the corridor for the 100-day journey, but that doesn't mean we didn't enjoy a few nice meals or sleep in a bed on occasion. When there was a hunting camp or a cattle ranch or a park ranger's house or office, there were times when we were actually able to enjoy a sit-down dinner and sleep in a bed, but we camped 80% of the time at least. You know, 5 days a week, at least we were in tents. But we stayed in the corridor for the 100 days straight and didn't leave it.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with two people, Carlton Ward, who is a nature photographer and writer, and Mallory Dimmitt, who is a conservation scientist and the project director of something called the Florida Wildlife Corridor Project. So, Mallory, let's turn to you. What is a wildlife corridor?
A wildlife corridor is an area of habitat connecting wildlife populations that allows for an exchange of individuals between populations. So in this case, you know, we really are talking about movement corridors that protect Florida's wide-ranging species, but also protect the various habitat types that will ensure the protection of all species that use those habitats.
Are there other corridors like that around the country, or is this a novel idea in Florida?
There are corridors around the country and around the world. Probably the most well-known is the Yellowstone to Yukon corridor that connects, obviously, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem to Alaska. And there are some that are specific to individual species, like the Pathway for Pronghorn and others. But this is a newly minted campaign in Florida to raise awareness for this opportunity. So while the science has been ongoing for a number of years in Florida about a wildlife corridor, our expedition in 2012 was the first sort of real public awareness to the effort.
Is a wildlife corridor like this, is it mainly for migration of animals, you know, in this case, north-south through Florida, or is it mainly just for habitat and general moving around within their territory, or both, or other things too? Or, you know, what are the purposes of a corridor like that for animals?
It's both for habitat and movement. So, as I've mentioned, Florida has a lot of unique, wide-ranging species like the Florida panther and Florida black bear, but it also provides habitat for sort of lesser-known species or species that don't roam as large of an area, and also just a connected diversity of habitat types that capture even animals who don't spend all their time in Florida, for example, like the swallowtail kite, who migrates to and from South America, but part of its life cycle annually is in Florida.
So how big, in the case of Florida, how big or like how wide and how long does a corridor have to be effective? Particularly, I guess it's the length of the state. So how wide does it have to be?
Sure. Well, the opportunity area that we traversed in 2012 is about 7 million acres. So as you said, it's, you know, 400 plus miles north to south, and in places, you know, almost half that wide or 100 more miles wide. But then it narrows down in spots to be closer to about a mile wide, or there are some places where the corridor is in real jeopardy of being sort of pinched off and closed off and losing that north-south connection for good. So we really tried to bring awareness to those narrow pinch points, but there were also times when, you know, the corridor is well protected, for example, in Everglades National Park and other places that have protected big areas of habitat.
There must be other purposes for a wildlife corridor that are beneficial to people as well as to the animals that that can live and move around in them. I mean, I guess it's, you know, in general, it's a very large environmental or ecological reserve. So what are some beneficial purposes for the human wildlife and tame life in the areas?
Well, the benefits to people are really in terms of clean water and clean air that we drink and breathe that supply our populations, but also sort of quality of life issues as well. So this wildlife corridor has a lot of opportunities for recreation, and it's also part of the economy. The rural economy of Florida is based on agricultural production, and that agricultural production area overlaps, you know, almost entirely with the wildlife corridor opportunity area.
So in going 1,000 zigzag miles, but 400 some odd miles as the crow flies, I guess, you must have crossed through some distinctively different environmental zones as you went, right? From the, you know, the subtropical Everglades at the tip of Florida up through basically almost into temperate zones. So kind of describe just briefly, you know, what those zones are that you went through as you went from south to north.
Sure. We started at the saltwater edge, so at the edge of Florida Bay in the saltwater, and we transitioned into mangrove habitat and then freshwater river of grass of the Everglades and worked our way through the sort of greater Everglades near Lake Okeechobee and finally up onto the Lake Wales Ridge, which is Florida's highlands, if you can call areas of 300 plus elevation feet above sea level highland areas. But that ridge ecosystem, of course, brings a totally different type of environment and species that are evolved there and nowhere else in the world, such as Florida scrub jays and indigo snakes and other things that are reliant on that scrub habitat. So we experienced different wildlife at each one of these zones, starting with the crocodile, and that was our very first species that we sighted at the beginning of the trip. And then I mentioned some of the sort of upland scrub species, and in the end, in Okefenokee, we were back with American alligators, which I would say are the most prevalent sort of wildlife species that we saw throughout the journey.
Mm-hmm. I would think you would have seen probably some of the more elusive things, maybe a bobcat or two. I doubt you saw a panther, but did you know anything really dramatic that way?
Well, we were a large group traveling, and we weren't very quiet. So anything, you know, most wildlife knew that we were coming, and instead of seeing individuals themselves, we saw signs in terms of tracks and scat from panthers and Florida black bears and other species.
Carlton, turning to you again, were there some moments or experiences that really stood out for you?
Absolutely. A large part of the inspiration for our expedition came from the bear research that Joe Guthrie was doing in Central Florida. And one bear in particular that he had fitted with a GPS tracking collar actually traveled 500 linear miles and 105 miles from north to south as it traversed a large part of the Florida Wildlife Corridor opportunity. So it was really neat to try to follow in that bear's footsteps for part of our trek. And while we didn't see bears themselves in the corridor, we did see tracks and sign. And in one place on a cattle ranch in South Florida, we saw a bear track and a panther track within 6 inches of one another.
Wow, that's amazing. I had no idea that bears traveled hundreds of miles. I mean, I thought they, you know, I figured they'd roam a dozen miles within a certain range or whatever. For one thing, I would think in the course of traveling a few hundred miles, they would either get run over or shot. But that's either one lucky bear or an unusual bear. Do bears in general travel that kind of distance in Florida?
Well, I would encourage you to talk to Joe in the future for more of the real science. I can generalize to say that young male bears, once they get pushed out of their birth territory, often by larger male bears, will go on pretty extensive walkabouts. I wouldn't say that every bear travels 100 miles from north to south in its journey, but this bear did, and it's certainly possible by other bears. There were certainly many roads to cross, but it also shows that the connected fabric of public conservation lands and working farms and ranches together in that part of the state really collectively form one very large habitat.
So again, Carlton, what was the worst part? I mean, I can, you know, growing up in Miami, I can remember going out into the Everglades or even along the edge of the Everglades in the late 50s, early 60s, and when there would just be, like, in the evening, a cloud of mosquitoes so thick that it looked like fog would descend. And when they hit you, you better be under something or covered with deep woods off, or you would be carried away and sucked dry. So what was the worst? I'm thinking that might have been a bad part. But what was the worst part of the trip as far as just the general experience?
The 1,000-mile trek was certainly arduous, and we certainly had a lot of brushes with the elements. But I can honestly say that the worst part was getting to the starting line. It was such a tremendous effort in terms of planning and logistics that the doing of the expedition itself was a pleasure.
So I was going to ask, Mallory, I mean, how did you fund the trip? How'd you come up with the money to, you weren't talking about staying in Hyatt Regencies every night or anything. I doubt it was that expensive, but still, you had four people out for 3 months. How did you come up with funding for this specific expedition?
Well, the expedition was funded mostly by private individual contributions and as well as corporate sponsors, and then by a couple of grants from National Geographic, Patagonia, and other foundations. So it was a kind of a mix that enabled us, as you said, to be able to eat and have the gear we needed and supply the expedition. It is, there are costs involved in something that takes 100 days. Certainly there are a lot of logistics behind it, and it was also a large PR campaign. So, there were people working behind the scenes as we went every day.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with two people who are environmental entrepreneurs, let's call them, working a project that's a prospective project called the Florida Wildlife Corridor, through the spine of Florida, right? All the way up through the middle of Florida in the interior, where it's still kind of wild and kind of like old natural Florida in many places. Their names are Carlton Ward and Mallory Dimmitt, and they were on this 100-day expedition that took place in 2012, and we'll get to talking about the future of this project in just a minute. But Carlton, how much of that old Florida is still left? I mean, people, I think who come to the theme parks and who go to the beaches don't really realize that there's a jungle out there, and a lot of it's rural, ranches and so on. How much of Florida is still old Florida?
Florida's development pattern is certainly unique. And if we all know that the coast is very heavily developed, and our state now has 20 million residents. We've just passed New York as the third most populous state. But even with all that, the majority of our state is still in either agricultural or natural conditions. Florida's 35 million acres. One-third of that approximately is public land, and one-third of that is agricultural land. Agriculture is a $100 billion economic driver each year in our state. And so it's the land of the cattle ranchers and the timberlands and the inland waters like the large lakes and the Kissimmee chain of lakes and Lake Okeechobee and the Kissimmee River, and really a vast wildlife and natural area existing still in the corridor. The number of state parks, the number of state forests, there's so much there for the public to experience and to appreciate. The Florida National Scenic Trail that traverses much of the state, paddling trails where you can paddle the length of the St. Johns River or 100 miles along the edge of Everglades National Park through the Wilderness Waterway or the Suwannee River, Apalachicola River. So much to experience. And I feel that, unfortunately, these aspects of Florida have not been very well represented in our identity as a state and to the rest of the country and the world.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so much of really all of Florida's economy from the beginning has been driven by tourism and by growth, in quotes, right? Development driven by people moving into Florida. And the real estate recession, the Great Recession, that started in 2007 or so, really. I think it started in early 2006 in Florida. But that stalled the influx of people to a great extent. But I think that rapid influx of people into Florida is about to resume. The last winter was very severe, and with the end of the recession and the start of the baby boom retirement, I suspect that there's a built-up demand to come to the Sunshine State that's going to pop and start to inundate Florida once again. Do you think these new Floridians Carlton will put more pressure on the undeveloped land inland from the coast than has been the case so far?
That's a very good point you make. And Florida has had historically 1,000 new residents a day moving here net. And that flattened out for a little while, but it's close to that again. So there is absolutely going to be continued a new pressure on the natural lands and waters in Florida. And that's why it is imperative that we plan and work to protect the Florida Wildlife Corridor now, while there's still an opportunity to keep our existing conservation lands connected to one another. Fortunately, in most parts of the state, there's still room to protect the natural lands and waters that support wildlife and support the human population here, and also to allow room for additional sustainable development in other parts of the state.
I know you're both integrally involved in this project, which is still just a project, right? So, Mallory, as the executive director, let me turn to you. What's your overall plan or strategy for achieving this ambitious goal of putting this corridor together? Do you have political support, for example? Is the state legislature behind the idea?
Well, we're getting there. Our short-term goal is to continue to raise awareness for this vision via a 2014 expedition to take place this fall, where we'll actually start in the heart of Florida, Central Florida, and traverse a giant arc around the Big Bend region and then west across Florida's panhandle to Alabama. And so that will be another opportunity for people to learn about the wildlife corridor and the opportunity to protect it. And it's a chance for us to continue to work with the legislature and with politicians and decision makers to have them come see and experience firsthand everything that the Florida Wildlife Corridor has to offer, both to nature and to humans. And so we were very successful on the last trip by having a couple of key individuals meet us at places along the way. And we hope to repeat that in this fall cycle as well.
Well, good luck with it. Keep pushing. Carlton, you mentioned earlier that you've written a book called Florida Cowboys, and people in general don't realize there are still large working ranches in Florida, and I think Florida was actually the first cattle state in the Union, really. And you interacted, as you just said, with some of these old-time Florida people on your trip, ranchers and cowboys, even a cowboy, or I think he calls himself a cowman, a poet named Doyle Rigdon, but also some old-time ranchers like Bud Adams, who actually was on this radio show a few years back, who's a very elderly guy now, but he's still plugging along as a working rancher and one of the larger ranchers in the middle part of the state, west of Fort Pierce, and Seminole rancher Norman Johns, and people like that who just, you know, very diverse bunches of people, a lot of them old-time Florida families. In general, Carlton, if you can generalize, you know these folks. What are they like? I mean, what's their general kind of, I don't know, manner or what are they like in contrast to the average Floridian?
The Florida ranchers, the Florida cattlemen, you know, they're all heroes to me. These are people who are protecting a living heritage that dates back in many cases 6, 7, 8, 9 generations. You mentioned correctly that Florida is the first ranching state in the country. Cattle came here in 1521 on Ponce de Leon's second voyage and have been here ever since. And it hasn't all gone away. Florida still has 6 of the top 10 beef-producing cattle ranches in North America, and literally millions of acres of our state, between 1/5 and 1/6 by land mass, are still working cattle ranches. The reason these ranches are very important to the corridor is that in many cases, the ranches protect maybe 30% forested habitat or other semi-natural habitat and serve as very important breeding zones and migration zones and just habitat for a wide variety of wildlife. But, you know, the ranchers themselves, they're kind of born of that land and they have such a connection to the land and understanding and are in tune with this large part of Florida that we all depend on. And to me, they're kind of guardians of this important hinterland that not only provides the food and the agricultural economy and protects the wildlife, but also happens to be the headwaters to many of our rivers and watersheds. And, you know, take the Everglades watershed, for example. 7 million people in our state get their water from within the Everglades watershed, and cattle ranches, to a large extent, are what are keeping the Everglades headwaters region out of development and into a green pastoral status that allows the rainfall to accumulate and allows the water to flow and be filtered and go back into the aquifer and sustain the drinking water for people all the way down in places like Naples and Miami.
You know, I think it's obvious in many places around the country, large landowners like the ones you're describing mistrust environmentalists. You know, they think they're a threat to their land and their use of the land. In Florida's interior, Carlton, are they in favor of what you're doing here?
Just in my 8 or 9 years of photographing Florida cattle ranches, I've seen a real heightened appreciation and collaboration between the environmental and the landowner community. And it's come from both sides. On one hand, you have high-level groups like the U.S. Department of Interior and former Secretary Ken Salazar and current Secretary Sally Jewell, both coming down to Florida and recognizing explicitly that the working rural ranch landscape of the Everglades headwaters is so important to their large-scale environmental goals that protecting and sustaining the working ranch lands and the heritage is a stated part of their priorities for things like the Everglades Headwaters National Conservation Area. So the environmental community is recognizing the contribution of the ranchers, and through a long series of good work by groups like the Nature Conservancy and the state agencies and others, the ranchers and the environmentalists have really been working together for some period of time. And it's by doing things like conservation easements where we invest in helping these landowners stay on the land by purchasing their development rights that we can actually accomplish a future for agricultural and ranching and a future for the wildlife corridor at the same time.
Mallory, what's the best hope for preserving the wild parts of Florida's interior? Is it more awareness on the part of Floridians, new and old?
Yes, awareness is the critical first step. So we're hoping that people will follow along on this journey and then share it with their friends, recruit sort of 5 other people to follow along and actually, you know, watch the trek of our next expedition and even try and get classrooms or others interested. Because that is an important first step, just to have a base of support of people who know about the wildlife corridor as an opportunity and then who are willing to talk to their politicians and support the programs that provide funding for actually permanent protection and designation of the corridor.
Yeah, I guess the key is just to magnify everything, to do it on a larger scale. I mean, it's good to have radio shows like this and more of them, and TV shows and more magazine articles like the ones that Carlton writes. There are ecotourism venues like Forever Florida and Holapaw, and the Adams Ranch west of Fort Pierce near Okeechobee has tours of the backcountry like that. But gosh, I guess legislative action is a key thing, and nature conservancy type organizations and that kind of thing can provide funding. But I hope our listeners can help support this Florida Wildlife Corridor project. One thing you can do is go to floridawildlifecorridor.com, just spell like it sounds, floridawildlifecorridor.com, and also go to Carlton's website, which is carltonward.com, where there are some gorgeous photos of Florida's backcountry, both the wildlife and just the nature in general. Well, I want to thank you both, Carlton and Mallory, for being on with us in American Variety, and I wish you so much luck with the Florida Wildlife Corridor project.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.